Before we get rolling here, let's take a quick minute to talk about the Stars and Stripes Chrome Soft Truvis golf ball that Callaway released last month. It's one of the coolest looking golf balls I've seen, and it features Callaway's popular Truvis pattern in the patriotic red, white, and blue design, which is fitting as all of Callaway's Chrome Soft balls are made here in the U.S., and of course it is U.S. Open week. In fact, the Callaway players are going to be using these Truvis balls on the range this week. The ball features everything you love about the performance of Chrome Soft, including the graphene-infused outer core. This allows Callaway to engineer an incredible-feeling golf ball that's low spin off the tee with the increased shot-stopping spin around the green. These golf balls are often offered in limited quantities, are available for purchase at select retailers and online. Visit CallawayGolf.com for more info and be sure to pick up yours before they're gone. Let's get to the podcast.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
All right, guys, we're going to get shortly here to our interview with Mike Davis. We had about 25 minutes with him this morning. This is Monday of U.S. Open week. So we're going to play that for you and then stick around to after that. The whole crew here is going to talk a bit about what Mike had to say. We're going to talk U.S. Open setups and whatnot. But for now, let's get to Mike Davis. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. We're joined today, maybe the busiest man in the world this week, the CEO of the USGA, Mr. Mike Davis. Mike, I know you're going to get a ton of questions about the U.S. Open and all that. We're going to get into that, but I kind of want to get into first a bit of your background, how you grew up in the game of golf, what kind of golf courses you like to play, where you play now, and kind of your own personal history with the game of golf.
Well, listen, I started out, first of all, it's great to be with you, and I started out at a fairly young age. I think I was maybe eight years old, and I used to tag along with my father, and this was in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, so they were members of Chambersburg Country Club, and from a very young age, I fell in love with the game. I played junior golf and then went on to play college golf, but, I've loved it from the perspective I loved the competition. Followed the PGA Tour for many years, and I can remember my father taking me to the 1975 Ryder Cup, and I went to the 1980 and 1981 U.S. Opens that were held at Baldersville and Marion, respectively. And there was another part of it I always enjoyed was just studying golf courses. I from a very young age, had a love of golf courses and architecture. And, it's such a unique thing about our game that other sports really don't offer is that the playing field is so different in our sport versus others that and it's something even to this day, I still love playing the game, but I find myself oftentimes out on a golf course, particularly those that I haven't seen before, looking around at the architecture and thinking about what the person who designed it and built it was thinking on certain things and, different grasses, the humps and bumps. And so from a very, very young age, I've just been enamored with the game and continue to be to this day.
So what is, one of the, obviously your main responsibilities over the years has been being in charge of the course setup for the U.S. Open. And we're just kind of curious as to what your game is like. The guy that's kind of in charge of all the setups, are you a bomber? Are you pretty straight hitter? Like, what is your golf game like?
Well, listen, as I've gotten older, I'm getting shorter and more crooked. So,
is that why the fairways are getting wider at the U.S. Open?
Exactly. Yeah, it's my I need more width, but. I did play competitive golf, but certainly did not play at the level of these U.S. Open players. But I've been around it, most of my life. And while I can't play to their level of the game anymore, I do understand their game. So when I can understand, and I watch a lot, if they're hitting a six iron, I understand by and large what they can do with that six iron, the trajectory they can hit it, how fast they can stop it. I think that by and large understand, again, can't play anymore at that level. But But I think that just there's such an interest, you know, in that game at the elite level that, you know, listen, I would say in terms of golf course setup, I've always felt that for somebody to have competency in it, they really needed four different things. And one of that is to understand the players that are playing in a given event. So if you're setting up the U.S. Open or you're setting up the U.S. Women's Open or you're setting up a, you know, your club championship at your golf course, you need to understand the capabilities of the players playing. A second thing, I really do firmly believe that having an interest and an understanding in golf course architecture is very important in terms of setting up a golf course. You really have to get into the mind of what did the architect want each hole to be played? What you know, was it a green that's accepting of a very long shot that you can bounce in? Is it typically played downwind? Or is it a smaller green that's maybe fronted with a bunker or a water hazard that you have to fly? And you know, with that in mind, how firm can the greens be? And, you know, you work your way from the green back to the drive zone and say, you know, what did the architect want the drive zone to be? And then you work your way back to the bunker, you know, excuse me, to the teeing ground. So in some ways, to set up a golf course, you really do have to dissect each hole and think about how that hole fits. And then there's a cadence to the golf course is that, you know, you don't necessarily want a bunch of long holes in a row. You want a nice balance, a nice rhythm, ebb and flow. And then beyond architecture, you really do need to understand agronomics. You need to understand grasses. And I say that because grasses react differently. I mean, a ryegrass rough, for example, is very different from a bluegrass rough. And when you get a wet ryegrass rough, the club slips through it, you know, just easy. When ryegrass gets dry, it gets very tacky. Bluegrass tends to be a little thicker, and particularly when it's wet. Bermuda grass, the ball in the rough tends to sink down. Fescue grass, you know, tends to just go dormant if it doesn't get enough water versus other grasses will literally die on you. So understanding all those things about grasses and how, you know, maybe on the putting green, you know, if there's a blend of poana versus bent, you know, how's that going to affect the roll of the ball late in the day? Versus maybe it's a Bermuda grass green and there's grain in it. And how does that affect things? So knowing agronomy really is important. And then the last part is just it's Mother Nature. It's understanding what the weather might do to the golf course and your setup. So, you know, is it a hole that's into the wind or downwind? Is it a crosswind? What's the evaporation rate on a given day and how much is the golf course going to dry out? So if it's a humid day with cloud cover, you know, you can put a little less water on the golf course if you're lucky enough to have firm conditions and maybe get away with it. But, you know, here's an example this week at Shinnecock where this is a sand-based golf course. It dries out quickly. It's a windy golf course. And so for us, understanding how quickly moisture leaves the ground is very important because we want to make sure that the golf course is a proper test, not only in the morning, but also in the afternoon. So all those play into, you know, what we look at when we're setting up the golf course.
So along those lines, I know we were at the media day and you talked a bit about C.B. McDonald and William Flynn and the history of Shinnecock Hills, restoring shot values. And I think people are going to see a much different Shinnecock Hills in 2018 than we did in 2004. But I want to know how much of that change is the club, is Shinnecock Hills responsible for? How much of those changes are the USGA responsible for? And what are the changes that you felt needed to be made in your mind?
Well, a great question. You know, this you start with this is one of the greatest golf courses in the United States, and for that matter, in the world. This is the only golf course that's hosted the U.S. Open in three different centuries. This is a club and a golf course that's had a profound effect, and really the formation of golf in the United States. You go back, I mean, it's one of the five founding clubs of the USGA. It hosted the second U.S. Open, the second U.S. Amateur, 1896. And I could go on and on in terms of its history and its prominence and how it's affected and impacted the game. But, you know, fast forward to today and really where this course is, and to your question, the club has done a magnificent job in really restoring the grandeur of this William Flynn design. Now, William Flynn came in 1929 and essentially redesigned a course, and it was moved a little bit north of where it sits right now, because there was a railroad come through, and frankly, you know, the game had changed with innovations with clubs and balls. But you know, what Flynn designed in 1929 and ultimately opened in 1931, if you looked at an aerial from that time, and we have looked at aerials from that time, you'd quickly find that they have literally, whether it's the size of greens or getting bunkering into play again, and it's been a remarkable restoration. And that has really been the club itself. And we certainly didn't direct it, but we applauded that. So I think, in terms of restoration, what's different about this U.S. Open than what you would have seen in 2004 or 1995 or even going back to 1986 is that you've got bunkering that is now in play, where it's not covered up by rough anymore the way it is. I mean, it had almost just become these narrow hallways that, you know, that I think William Flynn, if he had been alive, probably would not have approved of. And now there's so many angles. There's just frankly more strategy. The greens over the years had become round ovals, and now all of a sudden, you know, the club has taken it back to the original. And they, you know, they did work some with Bill Corr and Ben Crenshaw that were very helpful. But the credit really goes to Shinnecock Hills and a few key members here that really wanted to see that great William Flynn design return. So, I would say that our input really was just looking at it from the standpoint of how we would set the U.S. Open up. We did add 10 new teeing grounds for this Open. So, you know, it's slightly over 400 yards additional yardage. And I would tell you that we did that not because we wanted more yardage and necessarily wanted to make it harder. We did it because it made sense to really get the course back the way the architect wanted to play. So there was frankly some drive zones that if we had not added yardage, bunkering would have just been taken out of play. And there's a handful of holes here at Shinnecock that have incredible angles to them. And we were able to, with some new tees, to get some of these, you know, these bunkers back into play where, for instance, if you play more left on a drive zone, there's a bigger carry over a cross bunker, but you get a much better angle into the green. So there's a little risk reward that the players are going to have and some options. And so at the end of the day, while it will look a little different, we think it's just going to play beautifully. And from what we've heard from players so far, they're loving the golf course and the architecture.
For those that it's well documented that the fairways averaged about 26 yards wide in 2004, and they're going to average 41 yards wide for the 2018 U.S. Open. But even before the USGA began the setup, the fairways, I think, were averaging somewhere around 61 yards wide, which you guys came in and did narrow them some in a lot of locations. Was that in any way a reaction to potentially the very low scores that came out of Erin Hills last year with the abnormally the abnormally wide fairways?
You know, I think it was, but it wasn't so much the scoring as it was when we look back at Erin Hills, which is a wonderful golf course, great architecture there, obviously a new golf course. You know, that traditionally was an exceptionally windy site, and it too sits on a very well draining, sandy, kind of gritty soil. And, you know, our experience had been last year that it was such a windy, firm site that you had to give the players more width for them, or it just could become an unfair experience. And, you know, as it turned out last year, the wind really was kind of a non-factor, and we got a lot of rain. So it just played slower and, frankly, wider because it was soft conditions without wind. And I think as we look forward to this year, it was interesting because we knew we were going to have a wider golf course because of the restoration. And we applauded that restoration here at Shinnecock Hills. On the other hand, I think we, you know, accuracy is part of a U.S. Open test. It's not the whole thing, but it is part of the test. And we felt that there were just some holes that needed to be narrowed. And by the way, when we talk about that 26 yards average width 14 years ago versus 41 now, it's not as if every hole is 15 yards wider. There are some that are, you know, down in that 26, 25 yards in width. And there are others, I mean, I can think of a couple that are 60 yards wide, but they don't play that wide because it's all about angles, saying you take the eighth hole, for example. Well, that's 62 yards wide, but if you take it down the left side, you've got to carry it some 300 yards in the air to make that part of the fairway. But if you can, and generally it's into the wind, you get a great angle into the green versus if you play kind of up the middle of the hole, it may be a 270-yard carry. And if you play down the right of the hole, it's 220 yards to carry it. So, you know, while that may be a 62-yard wide fairway, it from the player standpoint, they're having to pick a certain distance with an angle. So it doesn't really necessarily play that wide. And I'll also say, because the course does sit on sand and it's windy, whatever these widths are, they play narrower than what they really are because the ball's going to be bouncing. And again, it's trying to control your trajectory and your shape of the shot, and wind is, as we all know, is obviously more difficult.
Yeah, I think one of the things that gets lost even amongst the best players in the world is when they see wide fairways, their brain turns to, I can hit it anywhere I want now, and not thinking about some of the things that you emphasize there about playing up the right sides of holes and angles and whatnot. So I do like seeing that element brought back to it and kind of more of a test than just hit it long and straight every single hole. But one of the topics you touched on here was kind of the shapes of the greens and how some of that was restored, but also how some of the green surrounds are going to look different than they did in 2004, with a lot more short grass and the opportunity for that ball to roll away from the hole and have a little bit more challenge, a different kind of challenge with the approach shots around the greens. Can you talk a bit about the philosophy behind maybe not as much thick, heavy, rough near green sights and the different look that we're going to see this year for the U.S. Open?
Sure. Well, this is really going back to trying to be true to what the architect wanted. So if you go back and you look at Shinnecock Hills, this is what William Flynn designed, years ago. And this is being true. And what's interesting is this doesn't mean that every year you're going to see this happen. I mean, next year, Pebble Beach at the U.S. Open, you will see thick rough, generally speaking, around the greens. When the following year, you know, those elevated greens with a lot of contours at Wingfoot, with the flash bunkers, the thick rough around the greens, that's what Wingfoot is, and that's what Pebble Beach is. So this year, this is what Shinnecock Hills is. And what's interesting is that, you know, intuitively you'd say, well, if there was rough around the greens, it would make it harder. And I think most of these players would agree here that when you get firm, fast conditions and you get these closely mown areas where the ball all of a sudden, instead of rolling over the back of a green, stopping on an upslope in some rough, all of a sudden now it runs, you know, 30, 40, 50 feet over the green, and they've got this really tough shot to a blind green that they might putt, they might hit a bump and run, they might pitch. You know, it gives them options, but options aren't necessarily always easy. And just putting that little bit of doubt in their mind. And we've already heard players talk about that. They love that. And I think that if we get these closely mown areas right, you're going to see some players putt, some players hit kind of a bump and run, maybe with a hybrid or three wood, or maybe a little chip and run with a seven iron, but you also may see flop shots. And that's the beauty of Shinnecock Hills, is that it really allows the players to show their shot making skills. And I think we're incredibly excited about that. And by the way, the other thing it does is it intimidates players. I mean, I there's several holes out here that you're just saying, oh my God, if I go over this green or I go left of it or right of it, I'm going to no man's land. And you know, if it was rough, they'd know the ball's going to hit and just stick. But that's not the case this week.
You get maybe more feedback than maybe anyone else in the entire golf world, especially from the pros. There's a lot of complaining that goes on. I'm sure that some of it gets kind of brushed aside, but I want to know, what's the best player feedback you've gotten, or in recent years, feedback you've gotten from the players that really rang with you and kind of something that you actually did react to?
You know what's interesting? One of the things I've noticed over the years, first of all, with the U.S. Open, there's always a lot of talk about the golf course. And, you know, part of the reason is it really is golf's ultimate test. This is a different week than they experience week to week. They've got to be on their game. And if they're not on their game, whether it's their shot execution or whether it's their course management, this week will expose that. And so the players always come in a little on edge. And by the way, that's not something new. I mean, if you read history, this has been going on for 125 years. I mean, you go back to the late 1890s and you read about, you know, U.S. Opens played at Myopia Hunt Club. Same things were happening then that now. And you know, you talk of some of the greats from yesteryears, you know, Jack Nicklaus, he loved this event because he knew it was more than just shot making. It was course management. It was handling your nerves. And, you know, he used to think, one of the reasons I love the U.S. Open so much is that some of the players come in and they've already gotten in their head how hard it is, or their, you know, whatever feeling about the course. And he'd say, okay, well, I don't have to beat them because they've already beat themselves. But, you know, this is more than just, as I say, execution. It's a mental test. And I think that's one of the beauties. But, you know, back to your question about input from players, there are some incredibly cerebral players that will offer things up that absolutely we will listen and oftentimes do react. But, you know, I would also say sometimes you hear, you know, I'll give you an example. Sometimes you hear from players in practice rounds, hey, you need to speed the greens up. Other players will say, hey, these greens, they're too fast right now, or they're too firm, or they're too soft. And so we listen, no doubt we listen, but I will tell you, we observe more than we listen. So we want to go out there and practice days, and frankly, we do this in championship days too. We want to see how balls react. I mean, if, for instance, players are hitting mid-irons into a green, we might want a ball, you know, struck properly out of the fairway to kind of bounce, and then begin to stop. And so, you know, if you're just talking to a player, you may not get that versus if you can actually go out and witness it yourself and understand where the firmness of the green is, where we want it to be. And, you know, sometimes maybe we'll soften green up because it is getting too firm, or vice versa. We will firm it up because we're just seeing balls stop too quickly. So it's you know, the player input comes both from us listening, but also, as I say candidly, it's more watching than listening.
Your last couple here, I know you're pressed for time here, but I know you're a bit of a history buff, and I was just curious as to what are some of your favorite courses that, like, in a perfect world, you'd love to see a men's U.S. Open hosted at, but are considered maybe too short by modern standards?
Oh, boy. You know, if you go back, in some cases, maybe they are too short by modern standards. In some cases, maybe you just don't have enough space to put all the operations in. But, you know, if you go up and down the list of the greatest golf courses in this country, I mean, think about some of the classics that are in that top 50 list or top 100. You know, we can all think of some courses you'd say, wow, what would it be like if you had a U.S. Open at X? I mean, you know, like a Cypress Point is an example that, you know, it doesn't have enough space for a U.S. Open, and it doesn't really have enough length anymore. But it architecturally is absurdly good. It is just a great course that Alistair McKenzie designed, that's right on the ocean, that's a sandy site that's exposed to wind. And, you know, it's one of the world's greatest walks and architectural pieces. But, you know, it can't host it because it just simply doesn't have enough room for all the operations that you need at a U.S. Open. But, you know, that said, there are, you know, our list right now is so good of sites we have that, frankly, we have more sites that want to host the U.S. Open than we have room for. And so I guess that's a good problem to have. But there are certainly, you know, we all know if we follow golf and architecture, there are some really cool sites out there that would be fun to have a U.S. Open, but probably will never happen.
All right, last one. I'm dying to know. Do you stay in touch with the Jungle Bird from Olympic Club in 2012?
You know, it was what's interesting about that is that when that all happened, I think back that all of a sudden I see this person come on right in front of the camera. And you have Bob Costas of NBC doing an interview with Webb Simpson, and all of a sudden this Birdman came up on. And my first thought is, what is this guy doing? He's ruining Webb's big moment. And so I'm looking around and like, there's nobody going to do anything. So I just almost instinctively go out and grab him. And then as I'm pulling him off the green, I'm thinking, what am I going to do with this guy? And you know, bottom line, I tossed him in the bunker. But I look back and then I quickly went back kind of behind the green and I'm thinking, I cannot believe that just happened. Pretend like it didn't happen. And anyways, but he did. What's really interesting is he called me maybe 2-3 months afterwards, and he's really, and it's hard to believe, but very nice guy. He's highly educated. He was from England. And this was all about rainforest, basically deforestation. He was really on a kick to say, I'm going to show up at the world's biggest sporting events. And he's, I think he went to a Notre Dame football game and ran out in the field. He's been to I think he did a World Cup soccer. I forget where else he's been, but he was actually very nice. And I took his call and we chatted for about 10 minutes and haven't heard from him since. But, you know, it's funny. I Graham McDowell, who won our 2010 U.S. Open, he thought that was so funny. He sent me one, the same hat that this guy had on, which is UK flag. What do you call it? The Union Jack flag, and a picture of it. And I do have that in my office. I've tried to kind of forget that, but I look back and with some good laughs.
It makes us laugh every time. So, Mike, thank you so much for your time. Best of luck this week with the U.S. Open, and we'll definitely be tuned in and hope to do this again sometime.
Okay, Chris, great being with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Cheers. Thanks.
Okay, take care.
All right, guys, what did you think about what Mr. Davis had to say today?
I loved it. Always a fan. I think I could listen to him. He's a bit of a filibusterer, I think which is good. I don't, you know, no offense to yourself, but I'd rather hear from him than from
you.
So
that's the point.
He definitely is not a short answer guy, but he's very thoughtful and very calculated, but genuine, I think, is kind of my take from him. I'm a huge fan of listening to him talk.
Yeah, I learned more about him just in the kind of the research process too. I didn't realize he was like this guy from Pennsylvania that went to Georgia Southern. I imagine there was some culture shock there. So I think he's got a pretty interesting story.
Loquacious, even. That's the word that comes to mind for me. I enjoyed I enjoyed the interview. I wish it was, you know, I wish we could have a little bit more of his time. I thought he was going to be like kind of stiff and buttoned up, and I thought, you know, at least maybe today we caught him and he was just very open and warm, and I think much more personality shown through than what I was expecting.
I thought that you know, from a journalism perspective, I thought you asking about the Jungle Bird was an important question.
I was going to be pissed if you didn't ask that.
I thought it was a disgrace you didn't hold his feet to the fire on backstopping. Personally,
shockingly, in 25 minutes, could not
tackle
all the issues.
He's a setup guy, though. Yeah.
I'm kidding.
No, I think it would be great to sit down with him one time, and sometime not during U.S. Open week, probably, and just get his backstory and hear about him personally. A lot of different stories. I can't imagine the stories that guy has to tell. But he knows he's doing a lot of media this week, and it's a spokesman role, and he's going to hit the talking points. But I think we all agree this is kind of a different level of excitement for the U.S. Open going back to a course like Shinnecock than like some of the mystery courses like Erin Hills and Chambers Bay.
It's crazy. It's been 14 years since they've been back there. I mean, it's kind of the quintessential, along with Oakmont, I think, the quintessential
U.S. Open
course. Yeah,
site. So
it's been thrilling. Speaking of 14 years ago, it's been just absolutely delightful to watch the footage from that 04 U.S. Open of balls rolling off the greens. And I mean, it's just that it really, like, I know, you know, they'd like to have that one over, but as a fan who enjoys watching carnage, I've been a big fan of watching that stuff again.
It's amazing how, and I guess Oakmont has hosted two U.S. Opens since Shinnecock has hosted its last one. I'd imagine the 14-year gap is a lot to do with how poorly the one went in 2004. But I think, you know, when we were up at the media day, how much they talked about kind of this being a new era and all they've learned from that. We see a lot of like mea culpa admitting the fault in a lot of the mistakes they made. It does seem like they've learned a lot from this process.
I mean, Faldo said, welcome to the new age.
Twice. Welcome to the new age. Welcome to the new age.
This could be what he was referencing.
That might have been what teeing it up for the folks at Fox.
Great art takes a long time to process sometimes and interpret.
But I think a lot of what Mike says about golf course setup, and they've got a lot of criticism for widening the fairways at Erin Hills, which we can talk a bit about Erin Hills. And we're going to see a much wider golf course, obviously, this year than we saw in 2004. But he explained kind of the reasoning behind that and why, you know, some of those averages that are thrown off by like the eighth hole is extremely wide. But it's you stand on that tee box and it's not a hole where you feel like you need the width, right? And when we stand on like that third tee box, which is a 500-yard par four, it was like tight, just legally tight. And so it's not like it's just going to be bomb. I don't know. Just the reaction of some of the caddies have been out there so far this week, like it's going to be a bomber's paradise. I don't necessarily
I think that there's some funny kind of stats going off. Like, you know, I remember when Azinger was going through on the podcast and kind of rattling off some of the widths of the fairways and stuff. And he was talking about number eight. He's like, you know, that one's 65 yards. And when you're looking at it on a list, like, yeah, that seems ridiculous. But when you see the hole and it's like, well, no, it's a really short, like angular par four. Like that's why the fairway is set up like that. It's not, you know, a bombs away kind of like hit it wherever you want sort of thing. It makes a big difference. So just like anything, when you look at it on paper, it's a lot different than when you look at it in
reality. And the part you want to hit the ball into is not necessarily 60 yards wide. So it's not,
I think, I mean, we said it before, but I think, and this maybe kind of leads into the next point, but if they get the conditions that they want, like, this seems like it is the absolute perfect kind of golf course for this tournament. And the thing that's interesting about that, and I've been thinking about it more and more, and, you know, when you have a golf course like that where it's so dependent on conditions, and by that I mean, you know, getting firm and fast and not, you know, getting the right amount of wind and the right direction wind and all that stuff, you know, when you don't have that stuff, you have to look for, like, controlling those constants. And that's where I think you've seen the U.S. Open kind of become what it was in, you know, the 80s, 90s, where it was, you know, trees. You know, having tree-lined fairways, it doesn't matter which way the wind is going or, you know, less so. Whereas, you know, it's just interesting when it's kind of a risk when you go to courses like this that are so dependent on conditions and wind and all that stuff. But when it pays off, it pays off. And at Erin Hills, it didn't. And, you know, there was, because it was soft and because it wasn't windy and stuff. But, you know, when it does hit, it should be as good as it possibly gets.
Yeah, Erin Hills got rain week of, I think, and the week prior, and I've been tracking the weather in Long Island, and there's not been rain in the last couple of weeks.
Well, we got rain, and then the wind just didn't blow.
Right.
Well, we got some reports from some caddies that it's like, you know, 1978 British Open, like puffs of dust, you know, as the ball's landing out there now, which is sick.
Ideal. I mean, when we saw the course a few weeks ago, we were kind of, you know, we got an idea for the layout, but we both kind of walked away saying, like, we didn't feel like we actually played the golf course that these guys are going to play, because you could hit it in spots around the green and you're backspinning the ball up slopes. Like, it's going down the hill, but you're backspinning it up the hill because it was so soft.
It's
not that hard of a shot, really. That's what I'm saying is the course is defined by hitting it in these spots that you're going to make bogey from, like 100%, and you might make triple from it. So I think they needed that cooperation from Mother Nature. So far, they've got it, and if they get the right amount of wind for this, it's going to be probably like the best possible U.S. Open test you could have.
Randy, when the U.S. Open – when you hear U.S. Open, what course pops into mind for you?
Oakmont.
Yeah. That's pretty quintessential.
Shinny's not far behind.
Is that a weird way of pronouncing Erin Hills or what?
No. More than anything, I'm a car crash guy. Like 5-6 over as a winning score is that's what I'm here for.
You want the carnage.
Yeah, I want the carnage. I want it to be brutal.
Par's irrelevant.
I hope this, well, not to me.
But carnage isn't even, you know, you can have carnage without having crazy low score, or, you know, with crazy low scores, even if there's just some holes that are a little bit extreme.
Yeah, for
like
sure.
That little par three at Erin Hills was sick. I love that hole.
Well, that's it's looking back. I did a little research on Erin Hills and stuff and seeing, of course, 16 under par one, and there was a decent amount of guys, you know, resting at 8 under par, and there was a lot of decently low scores. But seeing, six of the top 10 in the world got ejected in the first two rounds and did not make the cut. Like Rory shooting 78, and Rom didn't make the cut. DJ missed the cut, and it was like the scores were the high scores were all out there, right? It was like a really strong dividing line of if you had your game on and dialed in, you could take it pretty deep. But man, if you weren't, like you were hacking out of that fescue for the 2 days that you were there, and then you were shipped out of town. I think if you put guys on a par 72 course and you get the soft conditions and not the wind, the scores were inevitably going to be low. And I think if they had set it up any harder than they did, and if the wind blew harder, and if it got any drier than that, then that could have been a recipe for disaster. And I think they are going to hopefully...
I take issue with the word disaster. I, you know, from my point of view, that's awesome. That's not a disaster. I think the disaster is what we got, which was a kind of a anticlimactic, boring U.S. Open from that standpoint.
Can we talk about...
Sorry to interrupt you there, but I think, you know, from my perspective at least, I think the disaster means something different.
Can we talk about... I had already forgotten Fescue Gate last year.
Yeah.
Where on Tuesday morning before the U.S. Open last year, they were out there with like weed whackers knocking down the fescue because complaining about it. I don't know if it was because the players were complaining about it or if it was just, you know, always part of the plan, like they kind of led on to believe. But
it's like once you look at the forecast and say, oh, the wind's not going to blow, then what's the reasoning for not having that?
Right.
Yeah.
That, you know, higher fescue there.
Well, I think it still played really tough out of the fescue.
Yeah,
the issue
for sure
was the top guys were not hitting it in the fescue at all because the fairways were so wide.
Right, and I think Mike talked about that on the podcast a little bit too. That, you know, I think that's like what you get at the U.S. Open that you just don't get at other tournaments. It's just this hugely serious dissection of the golf course, which is just from like an absurdity standpoint, it's the best.
Everybody gets
it
to put their expert hat on.
Exactly.
Well, I just don't understand the rush to, you know, at Chambers Bay and Erin Hills, what's the rush to have a U.S. Open there?
Yeah.
Like, let it grow in for 5 years or 10 years or whatnot. We have a plethora of awesome golf courses. Like, I mean, shit, L.A. Country Club's having it in 2023 for the first time ever. And that club's been around for decades, you know?
Yeah, I wanted to kind of get into that with Mike, and we didn't get a chance to, but just like what is kind of the philosophy in bringing in two new courses in 3 years and whether or not he views them as a success. And I think just inherently when you don't have the classic element to a course, players are even less likely to hold back their opinion on it. They have no membership to adhere to or anything like that. And there's no tradition there that you're stomping on when you just shred Chambers Bay greens, which deserved it for in fairness sake. But go ahead.
Sorry, I wonder if the promise to host a U.S. Open helped in the development of those courses.
For sure.
But I don't
think to like new stadiums
that immediate either.
Well, like baseball stadiums, like, oh, if you build a new stadium, we'll give you the All-Star game.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
5 years from now. It's just
kind
of an
impetus.
Yeah, I
don't think you can kick it down like, yeah, we'll build the course and you'll host one in 20 years. I don't think anyone's really signing up for that deal.
But it's also that introduces a host of different variables then that aren't present in other tournaments. Like you look at, you know, they at Chambers Bay, they hadn't been through a bunch of summers where, you know,
totally
with the fescue.
Oh, for sure. No, I'm not saying it was right or wrong, but I think it's a
weird. It
just
seems like a big event to leave all that stuff to chance.
Yeah. Totally. Especially when there are blueprints. But I think kind of going in line with the distance discussion that, you know, surrounds the USGA is we're, you know, in the last 20 years, we've entered this era where balls are going obviously way further than they ever have in the past. That list of courses is strengthening, Just shrinkage going on. So they're, yeah, maybe there aren't, they're kind of worried about just sticking to too tight. I don't think you can have too tight of a rotation though. I think the British Open does a great job with that, and they don't, it never feels too repetitive to go to the old course every 5 or 6 years or anything like that. But I don't know. I think the key has got to be, and I know Phil, you were talking about wanting the carnage. I think we all wanted to play difficult, Big Randy. But the issue is when the great shots aren't getting rewarded. And I think that's kind of what they feared, what happened at 04 and in Opens in the past, like at Marion and whatnot. There's just some holes that you can hit an absolutely perfect shot and play it right in the way that you think you should play it and it not work out. And I think that's the dividing line of, you know, I'm fine with a good shot getting ejected because of how hard the course is, but a great one, I think there should be some reward to that. So I don't know how you find that line though. That's got to be the hardest thing.
I think that's got to be the hardest. Yeah, the hardest thing in golf to do.
You got to fly so close to the sun.
Yeah. You got
to
be a habitual line stepper.
Well, I was gonna say, if a shot doesn't turn out well, is it really a great shot? I mean, not to get philosophical, but.
If it's not,
you can
possible.
Say it was a great play, but if it didn't turn out well, then it's not a great play.
If there's heavy. Literally no option to get it in position, though, that's kind of where, like, some of the Chambers Bay shots where guys were landing the ball left of the fairway and it was missing the fairway to the right. It's kind of like, all right, what are we actually doing here?
I think Gary Player had the best take on Chambers Bay.
Yeah. I think it's. I don't know. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
It's a travesty.
It's actually a tragedy.
I just like that these pros for maybe 1 week a year just aren't in complete control. And to watch guys like freak out and melt because they're not in complete control is fascinating.
That's why I think it's great when it encourages playing the ball on the ground. Yeah. When the ball's on the ground, they don't quite know exactly what it's going to do. And whoever's most in control of their golf ball when the ball's on the ground is, in my mind, the best, you know, the best approximation of who should win the U.S. Open.
Speaking of which, Big Randall, I know you love predictions. Who's going to win the U.S. Open?
Well, of course, I don't know.
but
I think in my heart, I believe that Mickelson is going to win a U.S. Open. And it seems like Shinnecock would be just about an ideal place for him to do that.
Is he going
to
go full button down this week? It's going to be kind of cool up there.
Good question. You know what? I'll say this, and I was thinking of this watching him in Memphis. Some of his outfits are a disgrace. And he wears these like all navy ensembles and
with the navy shoes,
bag grays.
It's actually a tragedy.
He needs to be white and black and just be really crisp this week. I'm a firm believer when he dresses well, he plays well.
He's got his aggressive colors on.
Yeah, he's got to leave the – can't get cute with it this week.
I'm going to have to fact check you on that because I feel like I remember him playing well when he's got, like, the really ugly brown pants or, like, the striped like the candy striper pants.
In a big tournament?
Maybe not. Maybe I'm misremembering.
Do you remember his Open Championship outfit?
Yeah, you're right. Just black and white.
Just black. God, it looked good.
And you know, the thing is,
bust some pink stripes out, maybe.
Well, studies have shown that college teams play more aggressive when they wear black. Is that the best Phil quote of all time?
It might be. They get more penalties.
Going into the final round of the Masters. Yeah, they play more aggressive. They get more penalties when they wear black. So I'm going to be wearing black tomorrow for the final round.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's when I fell in love with Phil. That's when I was like, all right, I get it. I see what you're doing now, and I'm in.
It's working for me. Tron, do you have a pick?
I
guess Randall, what was your pick then? Is Phil your pick with your head and your heart?
Yeah, I think Mickelson and Spieth will probably share it.
Okay,
two old playoff.
Two.
No, they'll end tied.
I'm just going through some odds here. Brandon Grace 30-1. That's ahead or same odds as Matsuyama.
Beware,
Phil.
There is a train that runs relatively close to Shinnecock Hills, though.
You gotta
wonder if there's some scar tissue.
Randy,
there.
I'm surprised you didn't say Bryson. You're a big Bryson guy.
Yeah, he might be.
What does the data say?
He's
trending.
Y'all watch out. Yeah, he's in a spot. Yeah. I wouldn't be shocked.
Our caddies said that he was out there like about a couple weeks before we were out there for the media day, and he said he shot 66 out there from back tees all the way back. I would imagine he would play the back tees, but
I think he's going to play it all the way back this week probably.
He's teeing it forward. Gosh, yeah. You know, my heart says Leash. 50. He's 50-1 right now. I'm gonna probably throw $100 on him.
Cool, man.
That's cool, man.
But my head says either Justin Rose.
Trust fund Tron.
Tron has hundreds of dollars. You throw it around.
Justin Rose, or I think John Rahm makes some noise.
Deej?
I was going to say Leishman as well. I think it is absolutely perfect for him. And he's been playing well. Sorry to be kind of tag team your take there, but I was going to say him
too. I pick Leishman for every single
one. Well, I was going to say Leish is I don't know if it's because of lack of confidence, but he was thirsty for the bump this week. I ran into him at Memorial. He's like, "Yeah, if you want to chat on the podcast before we go out there," I was like, "Why don't you go win it and then we'll do it?" But looking back at it, I was like, "He just wants the podcast bump."
It could be a good Norin week also.
It could be, very much so.
Randy's grimacing at that idea. Yeah. You don't want him winning the U.S. American Open.
I just don't feel it's a Norin week.
Okay.
I picked JT before the season started. I'm sticking with that one. I think it's a good fit for him. But again, let me obsess. We don't know. We have no idea.
The greatest player of all time has kind of been bucking his head a lot lately, too.
He's coming.
I was going to say, Tron going with Justin Rose?
No, and just, I took like, my not head. Even... No, I just, I'm trying to slow play. I don't want to jinx DJ. I don't want to,
Leaves me wanting.
I got Leish for Carnoustie. That's the one I had just teed up for him. I think it makes a lot of sense. But.
And then Rory and Fleetwood are sharing the title in St. Louis.
Okay, for the PGA.
Yeah.
A lot of major winners this year. Yeah. What did you guys think of?
Let me ask you this. If it is a quintessential U.S. Open, who are two or three guys that kind of fit that profile of a Retief, Goosen, somebody that's kind
Rose.
Of grinder.
Rose, for
Rose,
sure.
Like, yeah. Rose, like, that was the first thought I had.
A Gruden grinder?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As soon as you
could
said
be a good
Rose.
Ricky week. And again, I'm just lobbing it up for...
Wait, really?
Yeah, putting Randy on his back foot. Who else? Paul Casey. Could see him being in that profile.
You know who I think would be a... I'd be way in on him contending in New York? Poulter.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
And that would be rich. That would be just thick.
Rich and compelling.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of Retief Goosen not getting a special exemption from the USGA?
I thought it was a disgrace.
What's the possible reasoning behind not getting it? There's got to be something there.
I don't understand why they gave him one.
He got one in 2016.
You can get multiple. Yeah. I mean, I think winning...
Yeah, you can.
Winning two U.S. Opens might...
They probably didn't want to run it back that quickly with him.
I think everyone probably forgot that he won two.
Yeah.
I think including like the USGA might have been like, oh, shit, he won two of these things? Oh, gosh.
They're trying to just... One.
Maybe they don't count 04.
Forgive and forget 04. Yeah. They don't want to acknowledge it.
Just delete it from the history. That has an asterisk in USGA history.
Well, so who else has gotten special exemptions?
Hale Irwin won the U.S. Open on a special exemption.
Did he really?
1990.
Whoa.
Never knew that.
It's the first time hearing of this.
There you have it.
All right, here's a couple names that have gotten special exemptions, if you guys are ready. Ben Hogan.
Who's he?
Sam Snead. He was the Clubmaker guy. Sam Snead. Arnold Palmer. Aseo Aoki.
Arnie Wood.
Scott Verplank in 1986.
Scott Verplank in 86?
He finished T15.
No.
But according to USGA.org, he might have been an amateur.
Oh,
I bet he won. That was when he won on tour as an amateur, and... I bet that's why.
Okay.
David Ishii. Don't know who that is. Hale Irwin, 1990. Confirmed. Tron.
Teaching
Finished
Tron.
First. Jack Nicklaus. Arnold Palmer. Jack got a lot of special exemptions.
Well, that's... I think... Like, I would
Jack?
Think they'd be
One,
wanting
two,
to normalize
three,
it
because
they're
going
to have to start
six.
Giving cat exemptions starting next year.
Jack got 7 special exemptions.
That's a lot.
And his best finish on one was T27.
Not
think,
good.
Think of the guys that could have got that spot. Oh, no, I take that back. He got even more. He got one in 2000, too. Oh, that was a pebble. That's why. There were like 5 of them. Sorry to commandeer this with just reading things off the internet here, but 2000, all these people got special exemptions. Aaron Baddeley, Michael Campbell, Jack Nicklaus, Greg Norman, Curtis Strange, and Tom Watson.
Why?
Sick.
I mean, Watson anyways. And Nicklaus. You wow. can see what, yeah, anyways. And there's and it, the list goes on from there. Watson, Hale Irwin, Raymond Floyd got one in 2004 at Shinnecock. And Retief Goosen got one in 2016.
All right. Maybe they told him, like, all right, do you want to use your special exemption this year? Because we're only going to give you one. I don't know.
I think it's fine. I think getting one is more than fair.
I just don't understand. Ells and Furyk, they gave both of them an exemption this year. Why not Retief? Like, I understand if you don't want to give any, if you don't want the field to be too big or anything like that. But if you're going to give two guys that have won previous U.S. Opens,
yeah,
Ernie's won two, Retief won at this course. Doesn't make sense.
It's a fair question.
It's a disgrace.
We haven't mentioned the cat.
What do you have to say?
Well, will he make the cut?
I think so.
I'm still worried about the accuracy off the tee. I mean, when Cat misses, he misses badly. And I think some of the courses he does well at are the courses that you can miss so badly that you're like far enough right that you actually have a shot. And at Shinnecock, if you're missing, you're going to be in the fescue every single time. And there's no like, go way right. Yeah. Go way right.
I'm not
and
it actually lie. Works out. I'm a little bit disappointed. I'm just going through here on Wikipedia. I'm a little bit disappointed when Cat's U.S. Open record. He's only won it three times.
Oh,
yeah. It's the last major he's won.
I kind of attributed him more U.S. Open titles.
I got a funny feeling. I think things are aligning for the Cat. I'm not saying he's going to win.
See Cat, mate.
I think he's going to be top 10.
Can we talk about how it's been 10 years since he won a major?
It's a lot of years.
On a broken leg.
Can you believe that sentence? He hasn't won a major in a decade?
I could barely drink the last time he won a major.
I'm trying to think what I was legally doing.
Does anybody have a dark horse? Can we talk dark horse?
Cat?
Bryson is kind of a good dark horse.
He's not a dark horse.
He's 35 to 1.
Well, I think in the general public?
That's a disgrace.
I got
that take out of here.
Kyle F. and Stanley.
Yeah.
I think it could work out this week. I really do. I think it's going to be a ball striking, a heavy emphasis on ball striking, and the guy that's going to be this closest to the hole after two shots at this Open is going to make the biggest difference.
Is Cantlay a dark horse?
I think that works.
He's going to get ejected by the New York crowds.
Do you think? He might.
No. Do you think we're going to see Sergio 2.0?
Yeah, for sure.
This isn't like Bethpage crowds, though, at Shinnecock, right?
This is like the Great Gatsby crowd.
Is it? I mean, it's not like they just erect some wall.
No, I know, but it's not the same. Out. Like, Bethpage was, I don't know. I don't remember 04 being that, anything like 02 and 09.
Well, I think part of it is when you're in tight with, like, the corridors of Bethpage.
That's true.
Versus things are out in the open at Shinnecock.
I'm nervous for Patrick.
Really?
Yeah.
He should be nervous. I mean,
he and Jimmy Walker should be nervous.
Oh, man. I don't think the New York crowd strikes me as the crowd super amped up about backstopping. But
hey, one can hope, right?
But the amount of times that Cantlay looks at a target when he's standing over the ball, it's remarkable. I mean, I got the stop clock out when I was at Muirfield. I didn't want to say anything about it just because I'm already sick of people just mentioning it every walk of the – step he takes.
You got to remember, this is shot clock master season we're in right now.
This is true. This is true. We're living in a post shot clock era. So, if Cantlay is in contention, without a doubt, he's going to be hearing from the crowd in some capacity.
I got two guys.
Okay.
Francesco Molinari playing really, really well right now. I think he's worth taking a flyer on. And Sam Burns, 600 to 1.
Oof.
Wow.
Yeah, I like that.
Do we want to do who's not going to win again? Because this went so well for the Masters. Deej, you want to lead us off?
Well, okay.
Double down.
Let me reiterate. I'm going to say Patrick Reed doesn't win. He doesn't win the first two majors of the year.
What's he done since the Masters?
He's done pretty well, I think. He took a little time off, but it's been...
Let me remind you guys, the point of this is to pick someone who could win.
Correct.
But say that they're not going to.
Yes.
He's only played three times since the Masters.
Who's
not
going to win? 8th
place at Wells Fargo.
I don't think.
41st at Players. 29th at Memorial.
Oh, cool, man. I would say Rory won't win.
Okay. I'll say Big Cat.
Now I'm thinking Spieth might win.
He might win. Actually,
kind
of shocking that we haven't mentioned him.
Wait. I mentioned him.
Jason Day will not win.
Okay. That's safe.
He might.
He might.
Yeah. All right, this is good. These are a lot of guys that might win.
All right, we're on the record. You heard it here first. So, all right, we're going to be doing live shows here from the Kill House at least Thursday through Sunday. We're going to try to get one out Wednesday evening as well. Unsure on that as of this moment. But
we need Comcast to start bucking.
Yeah, we need to fix our upload speed. Has got some issues here. Dropping, if you're listening to this, it's coming out Tuesday. Today is the first episode of Tourist Sauce, our series about our trip down to Australia. that has been a lot of time in the editing bay for us. So we would appreciate if you guys would swing by the YouTube channel, check that out. This is the dream of DJ Pi, this series, and it's coming to life. And hopefully one episode a week for the next 8 weeks.
That's right.
Swing by the YouTube channel, like, and subscribe.
Yeah. Yes.
Big shout out to our editor, Matt. Matt Golden.
Bucked
his head hard on getting the series ready, and
Golden boy.
Couldn't have done it without the Golden Child.
Shout out to the folks at BMW for the support on this project, and we got hopefully a lot more seasons of this to come, but it was a lot to take in for a first time going around it. We learned a lot in the process, but
we had a little fun too.
We had a little fun along the way, but we're pretty proud of the final product. So swing on by, check that out, and in the meantime, we'll be checking in with you guys later this week. Crack on.
Cheers. Crack on.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most! Expect anything.